Imagine, if you will, a podcast. A podcast beyond that which is known to man. It exists in both fandom and discovery, in viewing and critiquing. My name is Matt Hurt. This is Anthology. Hello and welcome to Anthology, presented by ObsessiveViewer.com. If this is your first time listening, Anthology is a podcast exploring science fiction anthology storytelling during television's first golden age, beginning with The Twilight Zone. Each podcast, I share my thoughts on an episode of this iconic series as a first-time viewer, as well as share some trivia about the episode. I then end each podcast with a bonus review of a movie or show related to this week's episode. You can find more of Anthology at anthologypod.com, and if you want to contact me, you can do that on the Facebook page at facebook.com/anthologypod. You can tweet me at ObsessiveViewer, send an email to matt@ObsessiveViewer.com, or call and leave me a voicemail at 317-762-6099. And if you like what you hear and want to help support the podcast, please head over to iTunes and leave a rating and review. The more ratings and reviews I get, the easier it will be for people to find the show in iTunes' search results. Also, if you wish to support Anthology with your wallet, there's a button on anthologypod.com and a link in the show notes of this episode. Every donation made using the donate button goes directly toward the fees to keep the podcast running. So it's greatly appreciated. And on that note, thank you to Molly W. in Indianapolis for her donation this week. I really appreciate this support. And finally, if you're in Indianapolis, my friends and I at the Obsessive Viewer are hosting an event on October 14th at the Irving Theater. It's called Shocktober in Irvington. It's a one-night event screening of short horror films from local filmmakers, and we'll also be interviewing each filmmaker between each screening and raffling off DVDs, Blu-rays, and gift cards to local businesses. I think I'm going to throw in a couple Twilight Zone-related prizes for that. All the proceeds from the event go right to the Irvington Historical Society and help support a great community here in Indianapolis. And as a bonus for Anthology listeners, you can get $1 off the price of admission by using the promo code PODCAST2 when you buy your tickets. That's podcast and the number 2. And if you can't make it, you can still donate to the Historical Society instead of purchasing a ticket. More information on how you can do that, and as well as a link to buy tickets or make the donation, can be found at shocktoberinirvington.com. Okay, and today on the podcast, I'll be discussing People Are Alike All Over. It's the 25th episode of The Twilight Zone's first season, and it aired on March 25th, 1960. And for this week's bonus review, I'll share my thoughts on Target Earth, a 1954 sci-fi movie based on a short story written by Paul Fairman, whose short story, Brothers Beyond the Void, was the basis for this episode of The Twilight Zone. Before I get into that, I would like to just apologize for the delay in getting an episode up. I'm a little bit behind, and I apologize for the wait, and I appreciate your guys' patience. Okay, so I'm going to start off, as I usually do, with an episode summary. This is coming courtesy of The Twilight Zone Companion by Mark Sicree. All right, and of course, this is going to be spoiler heavy, as is my review, so if you haven't seen the episode, please go back and watch it, and then come back to this episode. When their ship crashes on the Martian surface, Markison, the optimist who believes people are alike all over, even on Mars, is killed. Left alone is Sam Conrad, who does not... share Markison's philosophy, and who is terrified when he hears someone banging on the outside of the ship. His terror turns to relief, however, when he ventures out and sees that the Martians are indeed human, albeit telepathic, and that they appear extremely friendly. The next morning, the Martians present him with a surprise, a house built to look exactly like one on Earth. Pleased by this, Conrad is left alone inside, but very soon Conrad comes to the shocking realization that the house has no windows and all the doors are locked. Suddenly, a wall slides open, revealing vertical bars beyond which stands a crowd of gaping Martians. Conrad is in a zoo. He cries out, "Markison, you were right. People are alike everywhere." Okay, and before I get to my review, of course, I'll go down a a rundown of the talent involved in this episode. Starring in this episode as Sam Conrad is Roddy McDowell. This was his only episode of The Twilight Zone. However, he was extremely well known for his work throughout the Planet of the Apes franchise and in the television show. He also appeared in one episode of Journey to the Unknown. The episode title was The Killing Bottle, and it aired in 1969. And he also appeared in 1978's The Cat from Outer Space, which that title alone makes me want to check it out. This episode also co-stars Susan Oliver as Tinya. This is her only episode of The Twilight Zone. However, she did appear in one episode of Night Gallery in 1972 in the segment The Tyne and Dance Cafe. She also appeared in the original pilot episode of Star Trek called The Cage, which has some interesting similarities to this episode of The Twilight Zone. And she also, kind of an interesting bit of trivia, she lived with Jim Hutton in 1963, and when they parted ways, she began focusing on her career as a pilot, which she was a very accomplished pilot, which I thought was kind of interesting. Kind of rounding out the talent for this episode is Paul Comey as Markison. This is his first of three episodes of The Twilight Zone. The next we'll see of him is in Season 2 in the episode The Odyssey of Flight 33. And writer for this episode is Rod Serling. And as I said before, it is based on a short story by Paul Fairman. The short story is called Brothers Beyond the Void. It was first published in March 1952 in an issue of Fantastic Adventures. And rounding out the talent rundown is director Mitchell Lyson. This is his final episode of three that he directed. We previously saw his work in The 16mm Shrine and Escape Clause. He passed away in 1972 from coronary problems, and previous to his directing career, he led a pretty interesting life. He was a pioneer pilot, sculptor, and a home decorator. He studied architecture at Washington University in St. Louis before he moved to Chicago to work in advertising for the Chicago Tribune, actually. And he also worked in an architecture firm. And all this while he was acting in his spare time. He eventually moved to Hollywood and he failed as an actor, but he was very, the sets that he created were very popular, and in the sets for theater productions that he made. So that brought the attention of Cecil B. DeMille, who signed him on as a costume designer, just kind of randomly. Like, Lyson had no previous experience at all. And so he worked with DeMille up until about 1922. Then he moved on to design costumes at United Artists, and then continued to design costumes for a lot of his, like many of the cast members in the movies that he directed later in his career. Okay, so having run down the talent for this episode, we've come to my feelings as a first-time viewer of the episode. And before I get to my actual review, again, I just want to just mention that previous to watching this episode, I knew nothing about it except the title. The title is kind of a popular title in Twilight Zone, at least conversations, I guess. And I was glad that I didn't know anything about it, because there's some pretty interesting stuff in this episode, as I'll go on to mention. So, going into my first time watching this episode, I was immediately interested when I saw that this episode has to do with space travel. Because I really like it when the series involves space travel, because it does what a lot of great movies and shows do, is that it acts as kind of a time capsule for its era. Like, this episodes like this and stories like this show the optimism that people have or had for the American space program in the future of space. Granted, it is, I mean, it's science fiction, you know, they're pulling from, you know, what's hot in that day and age, I'm sure. But it's also just really kind of nice to see that, you know, the thought of men traveling to Mars isn't out of, you know, the grasp of imagination. And it's nice to see that, because it's just kind of depressing these days, because the current state of space travel is, I mean, we're not really going to Mars or anything, but I don't know. It's nice when the show deals with this type of thing. And as far as the opening narration, I absolutely love, it's one of my favorite things about this episode specifically. I love the way that he writes the opening narration, Serling does. And especially not knowing what the end of the episode was, like going into it and not knowing anything about the plot. I just thought that Serling describing humans as animals was just cheeky and colorful descriptions on his part. And I put in my notes, like, I really like the way that he's describing the characters. It's kind of cool. And then when he goes on to repeat that in the closing narration, it's such a satisfying moment, because it's a completely different tone and it's just incredibly effective. And I just loved it for that. I really did. It was really cool to have that experience of not realizing the deeper meaning of the words that he used in the opening narration. So throughout the first act, there's this episode kind of has some interesting things that it plays with throughout its runtime. Like, the first act has a lot of like a motif of fear of the unknown. It's like Conrad is terrified, and like that tone or that theme that plays through with Conrad's character, it heightens the tension while Conrad is fearing what's outside of the ship. And it really pays off really well in that first act. And the fact that he is he's petrified of what could potentially be out there is so, it gives so much weight to Markison's last words. Markison tells him that he wants to see what he's dying for, and that people are alike and people are good. And it just gives it such an impact. And I think I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself there, because I haven't even talked about Markison and Conrad, really. But that's neither here nor there. But speaking of Markison and Conrad together, it's funny because they spend such a short amount of time on screen together in the grand scheme of things. It's maybe the first act, really. And the story paints such a clear depiction of Markison being the hopeful optimist and really optimistic guy, while Conrad has this cynicism that's kind of steeped in fear. And while that may not be like a clear representation on his part, because Conrad's more of a logical thinker. He's a science-minded guy who's just fearful of the unknown, which is kind of weird in itself. But I kind of wish that cynicism that he has, or that kind of that attitude, was more clearly contrasted with Markison's. Not that it really needed to be, and I don't know. I just wish that the cynicism was a little more clear, because I think it would have paid off the ending a little better. But then, on the other hand, that would be pretty tricky, because cynicism in the lead character could be off-putting to the audience, and Conrad is our conduit to the story, and we're with him along the way. So it's kind of hard to pull that off. So I think that it reaches a nice middle ground of having Conrad be a guy who just doesn't really want to go to space, or doesn't want to. He isn't going for the adventure or going for the discovery. He's going because NASA or whoever need his mind for it, as he says in the beginning. But I do think there's something to be said about Conrad's intuition. You can almost argue that his fear that he has is more of a primal instinct, which is interesting if you view it in that point, because the entire episode is leading to him being confined to essentially a cage in a zoo. And if you view it as him having this primal intuition that he should fear the unknown, or he should protect himself from creatures he doesn't know, there's something to be said about how animalistic that is. And that kind of brings me to my next point. This episode is so creepy on repeat viewings, and it's so unsettling, especially the way that the Martians treat him like an animal. So we've already said that you can construe his reaction, or his fear of what's outside of the ship. You can construe that as a primal animalistic instinct. And then you can contrast that with the way that the Martians treat him and speak to him. In particular, Tinya, Susan Oliver's character, like she says this line to him that plays out like such a non sequitur on the first viewing, but then you kind of get the deeper meaning throughout repeat viewings, where she tells him that no one will hurt you. You must believe that. And at first, it plays like a random non sequitur, but upon repeat viewings, it shows how empty and how false it is, and how it's meant to be just comforting to him. Tinya kind of sounds like someone who's reassuring a pet. Like, if I was to reassure my cat that going to the vet was okay or whatever, it just kind of has that kind of connotation to it. By the way, I got a cat during the hiatus last December. I don't know if I ever mentioned her on here. Her name's Pizza Roll. Just that, the way that she speaks to him is so chilling to me when I think about it now, because it shows that the Martians don't see him as a person. And it's tragic, because he immediately identifies them as people. He thinks that they're people, and he sees them as human beings, and they can't give him that courtesy, or they don't show him that side of them. They don't give him that benefit, essentially. And it's really, just really disturbing. And to really highlight Susan Oliver's performance even more, there's just a wealth of world building in her performance. Like in the background, like when the Martians are showing Conrad his home or his cage, you can see in the background, she's not even in the center of the frame, or she's not the focal point of the scene, but you can see her in the background being very withdrawn and visibly uneasy. And it plays somewhat as attraction. It plays like she's attracted to Conrad at first, led me to believe that maybe the episode would lead to some big revolt, or like maybe she and Conrad would lead a revolt against some higher like government entity. That doesn't really seem like something the Twilight Zone would do, but I don't know. Or that the twist would be that the people aren't really people at all, or that they are actually like really disfigured aliens, or maybe that it was some kind of simulation, and that she is someone from Conrad's past, something like that. It all led me to think these different things, but it's really just her being compassionate, or being disheartened at the fact that they are capturing this animal from their perspective. And I thought that played really well, and I really liked the way that she portrayed the character in the episode. And alongside that, Roddy McDowall has, like, he brings just a ton of sympathy to the role of Conrad. And it's obvious that he's, like you said, he's the audience conduit. He's the lead character. He's the one that we're on the journey with. And McDowell just guides us through that arc really well, because he goes from being this fearful, reserved kind of guy who doesn't want to face the unknown, to having a newfound respect and a newfound philosophy that he picked up from Marcuson's dying breaths, essentially. Like this reassurance and this confidence that he gets, and this very positive boost he has, all to this confusion and fear and anger at the end when he realizes that he is a captive. It's really well done on his part. I thought that he did a really fantastic job. And then at the end, I'm kind of jumping around, but at the end when he is realizing that the house is empty, I thought that the style, or like the way that they showed us this, was freaking brilliant, honestly. Cause we as the audience are watching Conrad, as he's slowly realizing that he's trapped in the house. And it's really effective because the show turns him into an exhibit before it's revealed. We're literally watching him do these seemingly mundane activities for a few moments. Like he makes himself a drink. He lights a cigarette. He like walks around. He's doing his own thing, and it's through a couple different rooms too. And then finally he realizes, like you can see the confusion that he has on his face when he sees there's no window above the sink and the door doesn't open and none of the doors open. And it's such an effective reveal. And I really appreciated that we became viewers of this zoo exhibit for a moment at the end. I thought that was really cleverly done and really well done. I also want to point out that earlier in the episode, when they're in the spaceship after it's crashed, I love the score, and the score is effective and brilliant all throughout it. But in this scene in particular, I absolutely love the music, because throughout the scene, Conrad is afraid. He's not sure what he's in this new situation. It's after he wakes up and Marcuson is knocked out. And so he's in this new situation. He's terrified. And there's this music that plays that's very, how to characterize it? It's very atmospheric and it's very mystical. It really helps accentuate the unknown aspect of the situation that Conrad finds himself in. And I love the like music cue that plays once Marcuson like wakes up. It really plays on the bond between these two characters, because it feels just like a music cue to connect the two characters, if that makes any sense at all. I don't know anything about music. I really like the way that, at least in the first act, the Conrad and Marcuson relationship, I really like how their conflicting ideologies play out throughout the episode. It reminded me a lot of what I loved so much about Lost, the TV show Lost, which it has its detractors now. It's kind of, you know, infamous at this point, but I loved that show from beginning to end. But in that show, the conflict between John Locke and Jack Shepard, that conflict in that show specifically reminded me of this episode, or vice versa, since I saw Twilight Zone second. But it's a really broad connection. They're both characters who have opposing viewpoints of things related to their situation. And it's how they, I'll say this, in Twilight Zone, it doesn't, they're a little more polite about their conflicts. But anyway, and I'm not saying that at all to say that the Lost writers were influenced by this episode of Twilight Zone. I'm not saying that at all, because it's a really broad connection. But I guess it's just more of a reflection of my taste than anything, that I connected to this characterization of these two characters so much because it reminded me of things that I liked about one of my favorite TV shows. But anyway, so there is that kind of unknown fear or fear of the unknown theme that plays out throughout most of the episode. But obviously the bigger kind of message of the episode is that people are alike all over. And I mean, it's pretty straightforward. The episode sets up the theme in the opening scene, but it doesn't do anything. And this is kind of my not issue with it, because I really enjoyed the episode. But one of the things I kind of came away from the episode thinking was that the episode sets up the idea of people being similar or people being alike all over, as the title implies. But it doesn't necessarily seem to do anything to set up that people are bad. When I hear people are alike all over, I think, okay, well, this may be a story about good versus evil, or not good versus evil, but are people inherently good or are they inherently bad? And when Conrad at the end says that Markison is right, that people really are alike, it seems to be saying that people, as in broad terms, like people are cruel creatures. But My hang up on it is that nothing in the episode seems to have set up that people are cruel. Like we have, Markison has this philosophy that he posits in the opening scene that people are alike all over, meaning people, you know, no matter what they find, God created people the same all over, so they're not going to be evil or anything. But there isn't anything to really corroborate the contrast of that. Like, Conrad doesn't say, like, well, I hope not, because, well, I mean, that would be a giveaway the ending. But he's not like, well, people aren't so great, or people aren't so, you know, clear-cut and good as that. So at the end, when it seemed kind of off that Conrad proclaimed that people are alike all over, and that's supposed to signify that, yeah, people are cruel to animals, or people are cruel creatures, but there was nothing really of substance in that to really, for me, justify that statement, if that makes any sense. So yeah, I kind of thought that was, while I did enjoy the twist ending a lot, I still thought it was just a little bit, I don't want to say unearned, but it was a little bit confusing, or it didn't really piece together that well for me, or as well for me. All right, so I have a little bit of trivia to go over for this episode, as is the case with a lot of other episodes of The Twilight Zone. A lot of props in this episode were from Forbidden Planet, especially the interior of the astronaut's spaceship in particular. Also, and this is something that happens a lot, it seems, Markison mentions they traveled 35 million miles to Mars, and the actual distance between Earth and Mars is around between 36 million and 250 million miles, because of their elliptical orbits. But I just thought that was kind of funny. Also, as far as changes from the original source story, Rod Serling made some changes. In the original story, the protagonist is Markison, and Conrad is only in the beginning of the story. Serling also changed the end dialogue. In the original, it says, the character says, "People are the same everywhere." And Serling changed that to "people are alike" because it was probably a lot better sounding and not quite as flat. Moving on, the short blonde Martian, the one that one of the few ones that actually speak, he was played by Vic Perrin, who was the control voice of the original The Outer Limits TV series. And as I said before, this episode has some basic story similarities to Star Trek's original pilot episode, The Cage. Both feature Susan Oliver, and they both involve imprisoning humans against their will and treating them as specimens, which was pretty interesting. So that'll about do it for my review this week. Kind of overall thoughts on the episode is that despite some minor nitpicks here and there, and when I say minor, I mean very minor, just like the twist not being quite as satisfying as I wish it would have been, but it was still satisfying. It just didn't hit me as hard as it could have because I was a little hung up on the final dialogue or the implications of what Conrad was saying. It's still a really strong episode, though. I really enjoy it. Roddy McDowell's performance is wonderful, as is Susan Oliver's performance. I thought was very understated and very just really brought home the world building or the world really that was created in this episode. And even though it only takes up the first act, I really, really enjoyed the relationship between Conrad and Markison. I thought that they really developed that really well. But what I really liked about People Are Alike All Over is that this episode shows just such a big change in Conrad's character. The journey he goes on is just really harsh, and I love how Tinya's affection for him underpins everything and takes such a dark turn on repeat viewings, and the way that he goes from being this somewhat cynical or this reluctant space traveler to this fearful sort of coward, to this really hopeful optimist, to finally this prisoner who's trapped forever on a foreign planet. I just really liked that arc for that character and the way that the rest of the episode around it and the rest of the characters around it kind of informed that arc. I really enjoyed that. Before we move on to this week's bonus review, here's a highlight from episode 172 of The Obsessive Viewer, a weekly movie and TV podcast that I host with my friends Mike and Tiny over at obsessiveviewer.com.
There were three of us in the initial phases, and we were all friends. We worked together at the same place. Nice. We all shared a love of Mystery Science Theater 3000, and we would pass those DVDs around to each other, and based upon that love, we thought we would just sit down and improv movies, you know, on a whim after work. And so we would shut down the restaurant and hop into the bar and pop in DVDs and just improv riff. And we found we were pretty happy with the stuff that we were getting, so we decided to start taking notes and writing scripts for it, and over time, it just snowballed. I want to say snowballed, but it was a good snowball.
Right.
But yeah, it just got bigger and bigger until we have what we have today, and we hope it just keeps going.
You can find The Obsessive Viewer on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and at ObsessiveViewer.com. And you can find the episode you just heard a clip from at ObsessiveViewer.com/OV172. All right, so for this week's bonus review, I picked a movie called Target Earth from 1954. It was based upon the short story Deadly City by Paul W. Fairman, whose short story was the basis for People Are Alike All Over. And this movie was about a group of people who meet up in a deserted city. I believe it's Chicago, in deserted Chicago, when robots from Venus invade and attack humanity. And so I'm going to start by saying that this movie began in a really cool way. Like I like this type of storytelling to bring you into a story. So this woman wakes up and she's wandering around this deserted city, and it's just really, it's really good for atmosphere and mood and just setting up the tone of the story, that she's wandering through just a ghost town. And throughout the episode, or throughout the movie, I keep saying episode, but throughout the movie, it plays on some Cold War fears. The city was evacuated, and there was a fear of an attack and all that. And what it's cool because, and I enjoyed it because in the beginning, it's so grounded in reality. It's in those opening scenes, I never would have thought that this was this science fiction movie about robots from Venus. And they spend some time assembling kind of an ensemble of characters. And I mean, it was good. Don't get me wrong. It was good. It was enjoyable and everything. I just kind of struggled to pay attention to it, or I kind of struggled to really get into it the way that I wanted to. Part of that might be on me because I really expected this to be a cheesy sci-fi action movie based on the poster. But I appreciated what they were going for and what they did, because they did set up some pretty interesting character dynamics in those opening scenes. And then we see the giant robots, which since it was 1954, they were pronounced robots. I mean, it's cheesy. It's cheesy special effects, but it's pretty cool. I'm not gonna dog the movie for that, because I thought that it did it pretty well. It was pretty cool. But there are some pretty cool special effects of jets flying overhead, and the way that they did it. Like, there's some explosions that are leave a little bit to be desired, but for the most part, just seeing the jets flying around, it was pretty cool. Overall, the movie kind of reminded me a little bit of War of the Worlds. These characters, they kind of meet, and they're kind of forced into this place of hiding throughout a majority of the movie. What I liked about it was that the movie actually focused on them instead of being the cheesy sci-fi action movie that I thought it was going to be going in. It actually focused on the character dynamics and the characters surviving, essentially. There's a whole subplot with the military dealing with the robots that I wasn't really engaged with or didn't really care for. And it ends up playing into a kind of Deus Ex Machina kind of ending that I wasn't really too keen on. Plus, there's this... one of the relationships in it is kind of... I don't know, it's kind of a... it's a dysfunctional relationship, but I didn't really buy it too much. I did really like this one piece of dialogue. One of the lead actress says, "If anything happens to Frank, I'll never forgive myself." And then the other woman in the scene looks at her and is like, "Didn't you just meet him today?" And I don't know, just that got a good chuckle out of me. But I did appreciate the growth that the characters went through throughout the movie. And there's some interesting interpersonal conflict that arises that I was pretty on board with and really interested in. So I guess that's about all I have to say about it. Going back to the beginning where I talked about the characters wandering around in a deserted city, it really reminded me a little bit of Where Is Everybody? The first episode of The Twilight Zone. So I really got a nice kick out of that. But overall, I think Target Earth was pretty enjoyable. I've completely spaced mentioning this, but it's available in its entirety on YouTube. So feel free to go check it out and let me know what you think of it. But overall, it was pretty enjoyable. It wasn't as engaging as I would have liked it to be. And it wasn't as, frankly, not quite as interesting as I hoped it would be once I realized that it was a more grounded thing. But for the most part, it didn't have nothing that was included in it was too much for me. Like, sure, I didn't really like the subplot involving the military. I didn't like some of the character dynamics. I didn't like some of the, pacing that it went through, like the kind of slow pacing in the beginning of it. I mean, it's only an hour and 15 minute long movie, but it felt kind of long to me. Even with those issues, none of those broke the movie for me. I still thought it was pretty enjoyable. So, yeah. So you can check that out in its entirety on YouTube. And I guess that's going to just about do it for me on this week's episode of Anthology. It feels like this was a shorter episode. Yeah, it definitely was. I just kind of getting back in the swing of things. Like I said, I haven't had time to really devote to my podcasting duties that much with work and a bunch of other stuff going on. So I'm glad to be back, and I apologize again for the short delay in getting these this episode out to you. I will be starting my bonus review series on Black Mirror. The first episode should go up shortly after this episode, so probably a few days after this episode posts. And then I'm hoping that I can keep up with doing a weekly bonus review in addition to a weekly main episode. So hopefully I can pull that off. But for starters, or for the time being, I should say, next week's episode of Anthology will be episode 21, which, by the way, I'm up to 20 episodes. That's really awesome. I'm really excited about that because, I started this podcast a year ago and I didn't know if, I could sustain talking by myself for such an extended period of time. So I'm glad to be in the 20s now. But next week's episode is episode 21, and in it I will be reviewing Execution, which is episode 26 of the Twilight Zone's first season. You can also hear me talk about that episode on Submitted for Your Approval, a Twilight Zone podcast that a friend of the show, Brandon Cruz, hosts on geekgay.com. You can hear me talk about that in episode 26 of that podcast. And next week's bonus review is going to be the 1979 time travel movie Time After Time, which I've never seen, and I'm really excited to watch it because it's always been on my radar, and I'm glad that I'm finally going to get to watch it. So having said all that, once again, you guys can find more of the podcast at anthologypod.com, and thank you guys for listening. Also, I'm thinking about maybe making like a Facebook group for it, for the podcast. Let me know if you guys would be interested in that. Maybe do like episode discussions on there. I don't know. I did that for Obsessive Viewer, and I'm having a lot of fun with it. So I'm thinking that I may do that for Anthology. So let me know what you guys think. And yeah, that's about it. And thank you guys for listening, and I'll see you next week. Thank you for listening to Anthology, presented by ObsessiveViewer.com. You can find more episodes at anthologypod.com. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast app. If you'd like to help support the podcast, please take a few minutes to leave a rating and a review on iTunes. The more reviews I get, the higher the show will be ranked in iTunes search results, making it easier for people to discover it and grow the podcast. Of course, you can always email me your thoughts and feelings about the show to matt@obsessiveviewer.com. You can also tweet me at ObsessiveViewer, like the Facebook page at facebook.com/anthologypod, or you can call and leave me a voicemail at 317-762-6099 for a chance to have it played on the show. If you like what you've heard here, I urge you to check out The Obsessive Viewer, a weekly movie and TV podcast I host with my friends Mike and Tiny. Also check out The Obsessive Viewer blog at obsessiveviewer.com, where I write movie reviews, TV reviews, and the occasional editorial about the business of entertainment. If you want even more obsessive content in your life, subscribe to the Obsessive Viewer subreddit at r/obsessiveviewer, and check out obsessivebooknerd.com, our sister site for book reviews, author spotlights, and a general celebration of reading. Finally, if you're philosophically curious, check out my friend Tiny's side project podcast, The Secular Perspective, which explores the concepts of faith, religion, and existence from the perspective of secular hosts. You can find that at thesecularperspective.com. Once again, thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you next time.
Help your small business thrive and stay connected with the Comcast Business Complete Connectivity Solution. It's the largest, fastest, reliable network. Advanced gig speed Wi-Fi and cyber threat protection. Get started for just $40 a month for 12 months with no annual contract when you add mobile. Plus, ask how to get up to a $750 prepaid card. Comcast Business. Powering possibilities.
Ends 2/21/2023. Restrictions apply. Requires eco bill and auto pay. New 100 megabits per second internet and Comcast Business Security Edge customers only. Equipment taxes and fees extra. After 12 months, regular rates apply. Gig internet required for gig Wi-Fi.